Chapter 31 Galactics. The suzerain of Beam and Talon stepped aboard its personal barge and accepted the salutes of its Talon soldier escort. They were carefully chosen troops, feathers perfectly preened, crests neatly dyed with colors noting rank and unit. The admiral's Kwaku aide hurried forth and took its ceremonial robe. When all had settled under their perches, the pilot took off on gravitics, heading toward the defense works under construction in the low hills east of Port Helena. The suzerain of Beam and Talon watched in silence as the new city fence fell behind them and the farms of the small earthling settlement rushed by underneath. The senior-most stoop colonel, military second in command, saluted with a sharp beak clap.
"The conclave went well, suitably, satisfactorily?" the stoop colonel asked.
The suzerain of Beam and Talon chose to overlook the impudence of the question. It was more useful to have a second who could think than one whose plumage was always perfectly preened. Surrounding himself with a few such creatures was one of the things that had won the suzerain its candidacy. The admiral gave its inferior a haughty eye-blink of assent.
"Our consensus is presently adequate, sufficient, it will do."
The stoop colonel bowed and returned to its station. Of course it would know that consensus was never perfect at this early stage in a molt. Anyone could tell that from the suzerain's ruffled down and haggard eyes. This most recent command conclave had been particularly indecisive, and several aspects had irritated the admiral deeply. For one thing, the suzerain of Cost and Caution was pressing to release much of their support fleet to go assist other Gubru operations far from here. And, as if that weren't enough, the third leader, the suzerain of propriety, still insisted on being carried everywhere on its perch, refusing to set foot on the soil of Garth until all punctilio had been satisfied. The priest was all fluffed and agitated over a number of issues: excessive human deaths from coercion gas, the threatened breakdown of the Garth Reclamation Project, the pitiful size of the Planetary Branch Library, the uplift status of the benighted pre-sentient neo-chimpanzees. On every issue, it seemed, there must be still another realignment, another tense negotiation, another struggle for consensus. And yet, there were deeper issues than these ephemera. The three had also begun to argue over fundamentals, and there the process was actually starting to become enjoyable somehow. The pleasurable aspects of triumviracy were emerging, especially when they danced and crooned and argued over deeper matters. Until now it had seemed that the flight to queenhood would be straight and easy for the admiral, for it had been in command from the start. Now it had begun to dawn on the suzerain of Beam and Talon that all would not be easy. This was not going to be any trivial molt after all. Of course, the best ones never were. Very diverse factions had been involved in choosing the three leaders of the expeditionary force, for the roost masters of home had hopes for a new unified policy to emerge from this particular threesome. In order for that to happen, all of them had to be very good minds, and very different from each other. Just how good and how different was beginning to become clear. A few of the ideas the others had presented recently were clever and quite unnerving. "They are right about one thing," the admiral had to admit. "We must not simply conquer, defeat, overrun the Wolflings. We must discredit them." The suzerain of Beam and Talon had been concentrating so hard on military matters that it had got in the habit of seeing its mates as impediments. Little more.
"That was wrong, impertinent, disloyal of me," the admiral thought.
In fact, it was devoutly to be hoped that the bureaucrat and the priest were as bright in their own areas as the admiral was in soldiery. If propriety and accountancy handled their ends as brilliantly as the invasion had been, then they would be a trio to be remembered. Some things were foreordained, the suzerain of Beam and Talon knew. They had been set since the days of the progenitors, long, long ago, long before there were heretics and unworthy clans polluting the Starlances, horrible, wretched wolflings, and Timbrimi, and Fenanin, and Sorrow. It was vital that the clan of Guxiu Gubru prevail in this era's troubles. The clan must achieve greatness. The admiral contemplated the way the eggs of the Earthlings' defeat had been laid so many years before, how the Gubru force had been able to detect and counteract their every move, and how the coercion gas had left all their plans in complete disarray. These had been the suzerain's own ideas, along with members of its personal staff, of course. They had been years in coming to fruition. The suzerain of Beam and Talon stretched its arms, feeling tension in the flexors that had ages before its species' own uplifting carried his ancestors aloft in warm, dry currents on the Gubru homeworld.
"Yes, let my peers' ideas also be bold, imaginative, brilliant. Let them be almost, nearly, close to, but not quite, as brilliant as my own."
The suzerain began preening its feathers as the cruiser leveled off and headed east under a cloud-decked sky. Chapter 32 Athaclena.
"I am going crazy down here. I feel like I'm being kept prisoner."
Robert paced, accompanied by twin shadows cast by the cave's only two glow bulbs. Their stark light glistened in the sheets of moisture that seeped slowly down the walls of the underground chamber. Robert's left arm clenched, tendons standing out from fist to elbow to well-muscled shoulder. He punched a nearby cabinet, sending banging echoes down the subterranean passageways.
"I warn you, Clenny, I'm not going to be able to wait much longer. When are you going to let me out of here?"
Athaclena winced as Robert slammed the cabinet again, giving vent to his frustration. At least twice he had seemed about to use his still splinted right arm instead of the undamaged left.
"Robert," she urged, "you have been making wonderful progress. Soon your cast can come off. Please, do not jeopardize that by injuring yourself."
"You're evading the issue," he interrupted. "Even wearing a cast, I could be out there, helping train the troops and scouting Gubru positions, but you have me trapped down here in these caves, programming mini-comps and sticking pins in maps. It's driving me nuts."
Robert positively radiated his frustration. Athaclena had asked him before to try to damp it down, to keep a lid on it, as the metaphor went. For some reason, she seemed particularly susceptible to his emotional tides, as stormy and wild as any Timbrimi adolescence.
"Robert, you know why we cannot risk sending you out to the surface. The Gubru gas bots have already swept over our surface encampment several times, unleashing their deadly vapors. Had you been above on any of those occasions, you would even now be on your way to Silmar Island, lost to us. And that is at best. I shudder to think of the worst."
Athaclena's ruff bristled at the thought. The silvery tendrils of her corona waved in agitation. It was mere luck that Robert had been rescued from the Mendoza Freehold just before the persistent Gubru searcher robots swooped down upon the tiny mountain homestead. Camouflage and removal of all electronic items had apparently not been enough to hide the cabin. Malene Mendoza and the children immediately left for Port Helena, and presumably arrived in time for treatment. Juan Mendoza had been less fortunate, remaining behind to close down several ecological survey traps. He had been stricken with a delayed allergic reaction to the coercion gas and died within 5 convulsive minutes, foaming and jerking under the horrified gaze of his helpless chim partners.
"You were not there to see Juan die, Robert, but surely you must have heard reports. Do you want to risk such a death? Are you aware of how close we already came to losing you?"
Their eyes met, brown encountering gold-flecked gray. She could sense Robert's determination, and also his effort to control his stubborn anger. Slowly, Robert's left arm unclenched. He breathed a deep sigh and sank into a canvas-backed chair.
"I'm aware, Clanny, I know how you feel. But you've got to understand, I'm part of all this."
He leaned forward, his expression no longer wrathful, but still intense.
"I agreed to my mother's request to guide you into the bush instead of joining my militia unit, because Megan said it was important. But now, you're no longer my guest in the forest. You're organizing an army, and I feel like a fifth wheel."
Athakthena sighed.
"We both know that it will not be much of an army. A gesture, at best. Something to give the Chims hope. Anyway, as a Terrigan's officer, you have the right to take over from me any time you wish."
Robert shook his head.
"That's not what I mean. I'm not conceited enough to think I could have done any better. I'm no leader type, and I know it. Most of the Chims worship you, and believe in your Tim Brimmy mystique. Still, I probably am the only human with any military training left in these mountains, an asset you have to use if we're going to have any chance to—"
Robert stopped abruptly, lifting his eyes to look over Athaklena's shoulder. Athaklena turned as a small chimney in shorts and bandolier entered the underground room and saluted.
"Excuse me, General Captain On Eagle, but Lieutenant Benjamin has just gotten in. He reports that things aren't any better over in Spring Valley. There aren't any humans there anymore. But outposts all up and down every canyon are still being buzzed by the damn gas spots at least once a day. There doesn't seem to be any sign of it letting up anywhere where our runners have been able to get to."
"How about the Chims in Spring Valley?"
Athaklena asked.
"Is the gas making them sick?"
He recalled Dr. Schultz and the effect the coercion gas had had on some of the Chims back at the center. The courier shook her head.
"No, ma'am, not anymore. It seems to be the same story all over. All the susceptible Chims have already been flushed out and gone to Port Helena. Every person left in the mountains must be immune by now."
Athaklena glanced at Robert, and they must have shared the same thought. Every person but one.
"Damn them," he cursed. "Won't they ever let up? They have 99.9% of the humans captive. Do they need to keep gassing every hut and hovel just in order to get every last one?"
"Apparently they are afraid of Homo sapiens, Robert."
Athaklena smiled.
"After all, you are allies of the Tim Brimmy. And we do not choose harmless species as partners."
Robert shook his head, glowering. But Athaklena reached out with her aura to touch him, nudging his personality, forcing him to look up and see the humor in her eyes. Against his will, a slow smile spread. At last, Robert laughed.
"Oh, I guess the damn birds aren't so dumb after all. Better safe than sorry, hmm?"
Athaklena shook her head, her corona forming a glyph of appreciation, a simple one which he might ken.
"No, Robert, they aren't so dumb. But they have missed at least one human, so their worries aren't over yet."
The little neo-chimp messenger glanced from Tim Brimmy to human and sighed. It all sounded scary to her, not funny. She didn't understand why they smiled. Probably it was something subtle and convoluted. Patron-class humor. Dry and intellectual. Some chimps batted in that league, strange ones who differed from other neo-chimpanzees.
Not so much in intelligence as in something else, something much less definable.
She did not envy those chimps. Responsibility was an awesome thing, more daunting than the prospect of fighting a powerful enemy, or even dying. It was the possibility of being left alone that terrified her. She might not understand it when these two laughed, but it felt good just to hear it. The messenger stood a little straighter as Athaclena turned back to speak to her.
"I will want to hear Lieutenant Benjamin's report personally. Would you please also give my compliments to Dr. Sue and ask her to join us in the operations chamber?"
"Yes, sir,"
the chimneys saluted, and took off at a run.
"Robert?"
Athaclena asked.
"Your opinion will be welcome."
He looked up, a distant expression on his face.
"In a minute, Clenny. I'll check in at operations. There's just something I want to think through first."
"All right,"
Athaclena nodded.
"I'll see you soon."
She turned away and followed the messenger down a water-carved corridor, lit at long intervals by dim glow bulbs and wet reflections on the dripping stalactites. Robert watched her until she was out of sight. He thought, in the near total quiet.
"Why are the Gubru persisting in gassing the mountains after nearly every human has already been driven out? It must be a terrific expense, even if their gas bots only swoop down on places where they detect an Earthling presence. And how are they able to detect buildings, vehicles, even isolated chims, no matter how well hidden? Right now it doesn't matter that they've been dosing our surface encampments. The gas bots are simple machines and don't know we're training an army in this valley. They just sense Earthlings, then dive in to do their work and leave again. But what happens when we start operations and attract attention from the Gubru themselves? We can't afford to be detectable then."
There was another very basic reason to find an answer to these questions.
"As long as this is going on, I'm trapped down here."
Robert listened to the faint plink of water droplets seeping from the nearest wall. He thought about the enemy. The trouble on Garth was clearly little more than a skirmish among the greater battles tearing up the five galaxies. The Gubru couldn't just gas the entire planet. That would cost far too much for this backwater theater of operations. So a swarm of cheap, stupid, but efficient seeker robots had been unleashed to home in on anything not natural to Garth. Anything that had the scent of Earth about it. By now, nearly every attack dosed only irritated, resentful chims, immune to the coercion gas, and empty buildings all over the planet. It was a nuisance, and it was effective. A way had to be found to stop it. Robert pulled a sheet of paper from a folder at the end of the table. He wrote down the principal ways the gas bots might be using to detect Earthlings on an alien planet. Optical imaging, body heat, infrared, scan resonance, psi, reality twist. Robert regretted having taken so many courses in public administration and so few on galactic technologies. He was certain the great library's giga-year-old archives contained many methods of detection beyond just these five. For instance, what if the gas bots actually did sniff out a Terran odor, tracing anything earthly by sense of smell? No. He shook his head. There came a point where one had to cut a list short putting aside things that were obviously ridiculous, leaving them as a last resort, at least. The rebels did have a Library Pico branch he could try, salvaged from the wreckage of the Howlett Center. The chances of it having any entries of military use were quite slim. It was a tiny branch, holding no more information than all the books written by pre-contact mankind, and it was specialized in the areas of uplift and genetic engineering. Maybe we can apply to the District Central Library on Tanith for a literature search. Robert smiled at the ironic thought. Even a people imprisoned by an invader supposedly had the right to query the Galactic Library whenever they wished. That was part of the code of the progenitors.
Right, he chuckled at the image. We'll just walk up to Gubru Occupation Headquarters and demand that they transmit our appeal to Tanith, a request for information on the invader's own military technology. And they might even do it. After all, with the galaxies in turmoil, the library must be inundated with queries. They would get around to our request eventually, maybe sometime in the next century.
He looked over his list. At least these were means he had heard of or knew something about. Possibility one. There might be a satellite overhead with sophisticated optical scanning capabilities, inspecting Garth acre by acre, seeking out regular shapes that would indicate buildings or vehicles. Such a device could be dispatching the gas bots to their targets. Feasible, but why were the same sites raided over and over again? Wouldn't such a satellite remember? And how could a satellite know to send robot bombers plunging down on even isolated groups of chims traveling under the heavy forest canopy? The reverse logic held for infrared direction. The machines couldn't be homing in on the target's body heat. The Gubru drone still swooped out on empty buildings, for instance, cold and abandoned for weeks now. Robert did not have the expertise to eliminate all the possibilities on his list. Certainly he knew next to nothing about psi and its weird cousin, reality physics. The weeks with Athaclena had begun to open doors to him. But he was far from being more than a rank novice in an area that still caused many humans and chims to shudder in superstitious dread. Well, as long as I'm stuck here underground, I might as well expand my education. He started to get up, intending to join Athaclena and Benjamin. Then he stopped suddenly. Looking at his list of possibilities, he realized that there was one more that he had left out. A way for the Gubru to penetrate our defenses so easily when they invaded. A way for them to find us again and again wherever we hide. A way for them to foil our every move. He did not want to, but honesty forced him to pick up the stylus one more time. He wrote a single word. Treason. Chapter 33. Fibbon. That afternoon, Galet took Fibbon on a tour of Port Helenia, or as much of it as the invader had not placed off limits to the neo-chimp population. Fishing trawlers still came and went from the docks at the southern end of town. But now they were crewed solely by chim sailors, and less than half the usual number set forth, taking wide detours past the Gubru fortress ship that filled half the outlet of Aspinall Bay. In the markets they saw some items in plentiful supply. Elsewhere there were sparse shelves, stripped nearly bare by scarcity and hoarding. Colonial money was still good for some things, like beer and fish, but only galactic pellet scrip would buy meat or fresh fruit. Irritated shoppers had already begun to learn what that archaic term, inflation, meant. Half the population, it seemed, worked for the invader. There were battlements being built off to the south of the bay near the spaceport. Excavations told of more massive structures yet to be. Placards everywhere in town depicted grinning neo-chimpanzees and promised plenty once again, as soon as enough proper money entered circulation. Good work would bring that day closer, they were promised.
"Well, have you seen enough?"
his guide asked. Thibon smiled.
"Not at all. In fact, we barely scratched the surface."
Galet shrugged and let him lead the way.
"Well,"
he thought as he looked at the scant market shelves,
"the nutritionists keep telling us neo-chimps we eat more meat than is good for us, much more than we could get in the wild old days. Maybe this'll do us some good."
At last, their wanderings brought them to the bell tower overlooking Port Helena College. It was a smaller campus than the university on Silmar Island, but Thibon had attended ecological conferences here not so very long ago, so he knew his way around. As he looked over the school, something struck him as very strange. It wasn't just the Gubru hover tank, dug in at the top of the hill, nor the ugly new wall that grazed the northern fringe of the college grounds on its way around town. Rather, it was something about the students and faculty themselves. Frankly, he was surprised to see them here at all. They were all chims, of course. Thibon had come to Port Helena expecting to find ghettos or concentration camps crowded with the human population of the mainland. But the last Mels and Femmes had been moved out to the island some days ago. Taking their place had been thousands of chims pouring in from outlying areas, including those susceptible to the coercion gas, in spite of the invaders' assurances that it was impossible. All of these had been given the antidote, paid a small token reparation, and put to work in town. But here at the college, all seemed peaceful and amazingly close to normal. Thibon and Galet looked down from the top of the bell tower. Below them, chins and chimmies moved about between classes. They carried books, spoke to one another in low voices, and only occasionally cast furtive glances at the alien cruisers that growled overhead every hour or so. Thibon shook his head in wonder that they persevered at all. Sure, humans were notoriously liberal in their uplift policy, treating their clients as near equals in the face of a galactic tradition that was far less generous. Elder galactic clans might glower in disapproval, but chim and dolphin members deliberated next to their patrons on Terrigan's councils. The client races had even been entrusted with a few starships of their own. But college without men? Thibon had wondered why the invader held such a loose rein over the chim population, meddling only in a few crass ways, like at the ape's grape. Now he thought he knew why.
"Mimicry! They must think we're playing pretend,"
he muttered half aloud.
"What did you say?"
Galet looked at him. They had made a truce in order to get the job done, but clearly she did not savor spending all day as his tour guide. Thibon pointed at the students.
"Tell me what you see down there."
She glowered, then sighed and bent forward to look.
"I see Professor Jimmy Sung leaving lecture hall, explaining something to some students."
She smiled faintly.
"That's probably intermediate galactic history. I used to TA for him, and I well recall that expression of confusion on the students' faces." "Good. That's what you see. Now, look at it through a Gubru's eyes."
Galet frowned.
"What do you mean?"
Thibon gestured again.
"Remember, according to galactic tradition, we neo-chimps aren't much over 300 years old as a sapient client race, barely older than dolphins. only just beginning our 100,000-year period of probation and indentured man. Remember also that many of the E.T. fanatics resent humans terribly, yet humans had to be granted patron status and all the privileges that go along with it. Why? Because they already had uplifted chimps and dolphins before contact. That's how you get status in the five galaxies, by having clients and heading up a clan.
Galet shook her head.
I don't get what you're driving at. Why are you explaining the obvious?
Clearly, she did not like being lectured by a backwoods chim, one without even a postgraduate degree.
Think! How did humans win their status? Remember how it happened back in the 22nd century? The fanatics were outvoted when it came to accepting neo-chimps and neo-dolphins as sapient.
Fibbon waved his arm.
It was a diplomatic coup pulled off by the Cotton and Tim Bremmy and other moderates before humans even knew what the issues were.
Galet's expression was sardonic, and he recalled that her area of expertise was galactic sociology.
Of course, but it became a fait accompli. But the Gubru and the Sorrow and the other fanatics didn't have to like it. They still think we're little better than animals. They have to believe that. Otherwise, humans have earned a place in galactic society, equal to most and better than many. I still don't see what your look down there,
Fibbon pointed.
Look with Gubru eyes and tell me what you see.
Galet Jones glared at Fibbon narrowly. At last, she sighed.
Oh, if you insist.
And she swiveled to gaze down into the courtyard again. She was silent for a long time.
I don't like it,
she said at last. Fibbon could barely hear her. He moved to stand closer.
Tell me what you see.
She looked away, so he put it into words for her.
What you see are bright, well-trained animals, creatures mimicking the behavior of their masters. Isn't that it? Through the eyes of a galactic, you see clever imitations of human professors and human students, replicas of better times reenacted superstitiously by loyal... Stop it!
Galet shouted, covering her ears. She whirled on Fibbon, eyes ablaze.
I hate you.
Fibbon wondered. This was hard on her. Was he simply getting even for the hurt and humiliation he had suffered over the last 3 days, partly at her hands? But no. She had to be shown how her people were looked on by the enemy. How else would she ever learn how to fight them? Now he was justified, all right.
Still, Fibbon thought, it's never pleasant being loathed by a pretty girl.
Galet Jones sagged against one of the pillars supporting the roof of the bell tower.
Oh, Ifni and Goodall, she cried into her hands. What if they are right? What if it's true?
Chapter 34 Athaclena. The glyph Parafrenal hovered above the sleeping girl, a floating cloud of uncertainty that quivered in the darkened chamber. It was one of the glyphs of doom. Better than any living creature could predict its own fate, Parafrenal knew what the future held for it, what was unavoidable. And yet it tried to escape. It could do nothing else. Such was the simple, pure, ineluctable nature of Parafrenal. The glyph wafted upward in the dream smoke of Athaclena's fitful slumber, rising until its nervous fringe barely touched the rocky ceiling. That instant, the glyph quailed from the burning reality of the damp stone, dropping quickly back toward where it had been born. Athaklana's head shook slightly on the pillow, and her breathing quickened. Paraphrenal flickered in suppressed panic just above. The shapeless dream glyph began to resolve itself, its amorphous shimmering starting to assume the symmetrical outlines of a face. Paraphrenal was an essence, a distillation. Resistance to inevitability was its theme. It writhed and shuddered to hold off the change, and the face vanished for a time. Here, above the source, its danger was greatest. Paraphrenal darted away toward the curtained exit, only to be drawn short suddenly, as if held in leash by taut threads. The glyph stretched thin, straining for release. Above the sleeping girl, slender tendrils waved after the desperate capsule of psychic energy, drawing it back, back. Athaklana sighed tremulously. Her pale, almost translucent skin throbbed as her body perceived an emergency of some sort and prepared to make adjustments. But no orders came. There was no plan. The hormones and enzymes had no theme to build around. Tendrils reached out, pulling paraphrenal, hauling it in. They gathered around the struggling symbol like fingers caressing clay, fashioning decisiveness out of uncertainty, form out of raw terror. At last they dropped away, revealing what paraphrenal had become, a face, grinning with mirth. Its cat's eyes glittered, its smile was not sympathetic. Athaklana moaned. A crack appeared. The face divided down the middle and the halves separated. Then there were two of them. Her breath came in rapid strokes. The two figures split longitudinally, and there were four. It happened again, 8, and again, 16. Faces multiplied, laughing soundlessly but uproariously.
Ah, ah!
Athaklena's eyes opened. They shone with an opalescent chemical fear light. Panting, clutching the blankets, she sat up and stared in the small subterranean chamber, desperate for the sight of real things. Her desk, the faint light of the hall bulb filtering through the entrance curtain. She could still feel the thing that paraphrenal had hatched. It was dissipating, now that she was awake, but slowly, too slowly. Its laughter seemed to rock with the beating of her heart, and Athaklena knew there would be no good in covering her ears. What was it humans called their sleep terror? Nightmare. But Athaklena had heard that they were pale things, dreamed events and warped scenes taken from daily life, generally forgotten simply by awakening. The sights and sensations of the room slowly took on solidity, but the laughter did not merely vanish, defeated. It faded into the walls, embedding there, she knew, waiting to return.
Tutsunakan,
she sighed aloud. Timbrem dialect sounded queer and nasal after weeks speaking solely Anglic. The laughing man glyph, Tutsunakan, would not go away, not until something altered or some hidden idea became a resolve, which in turn must become a jest. And to a Timbrimi, jokes were not always funny. Athaklena sat still while rippling motions under her skin settled down. The unasked-for gear activity dissipating gradually.
You are not needed, she told the enzymes. There is no emergency. Go and leave me alone.
Ever since she had been little, the tiny change nodes had been a part of her life, occasionally inconveniences, often indispensable. Only since coming to Garth had she begun to picture the little fluid organs as tiny, mouse-like creatures, or busy little gnomes, which hurried about making sudden alterations within her body whenever the need arose. What a bizarre way of looking at a natural, organic function. Many of the animals of Timbrim shared the ability. It had evolved in the forests of Homeworld long before the star-faring Kaltmor had arrived to give her ancestors speech and law. That was it, of course. The reason why she had never likened the nodes to busy little creatures before coming to Garth. Prior to Uplift, her pre-sentient ancestors would have been incapable of making Baroque comparisons. And after Uplift, they knew the scientific truth. Ah, but humans, the Terran wolflings, had come into intelligence without guidance. They were not handed answers as a child is given knowledge by its parents and teachers. They had emerged ignorant into awareness and spent long millennia groping in darkness. Needing explanations and having none available, they got into the habit of inventing their own. Athaclena remembered when she had been amused reading about some of them. Disease was caused by vapors, or excess bile, or an enemy's curse. The sun rode across the sky in a great chariot. The course of history was determined by economics. And inside the body there resided animus. Athaclena touched a throbbing knot behind her jaw and started as the small bulge seemed to skitter away like some small, shy creature. It was a terrifying image, that metaphor, more frightening than Tutsanakan, for it invaded her body, her very sense of self. Athaclena moaned and buried her face in her hands.
Crazy earthlings! What have they done to me?
She recalled how her father had bid her to learn more about human ways, to overcome her odd misgivings about the denizens of Sol III. But what had happened? She had found her destiny entwined with theirs, and it was no longer within her power to control it.
Father,
she spoke aloud in Galactic 7.
I fear.
All she had of him was memory. Even the Nahakiri glimmer she had felt back at the burning Howlett Center was unavailable, perhaps gone. She could not go down to seek his roots with hers, for Tutsanakan lurked there, like some subterranean beast waiting to get her.
More metaphors, she realized. My thoughts are filling with them, while my own glyphs terrify me.
Movement in the hall outside made her look up. A narrow trapezoid of light spilled into the room as the curtain was drawn aside. The slightly bow-legged outline of a chim stood silhouetted against the dim glow.
Excuse me, Miss Athaclena, sir. I'm sorry to bother you during your rest period, but we thought you'd want to know.
Athaclena swallowed, chasing more mice from her throat. She shivered and concentrated on Anglic.
Yes? What is it?
The Jim stepped forward, partly cutting off the light.
It's Captain On-Eagle, sir. I'm afraid we can't locate him anywhere.
Athaclena blinked.
Robert?
The Jim nodded.
He's gone, sir. He's just plain disappeared.